I would like to introduce our keynote speaker for this evening, Melissa from New York.
Take a second. Hi. Well, hello. My name is Melissa C. I am a recovered compulsive overeater. Hi. Thank you. Oh my gosh, this is incredible. Thank you so much to all the organizers from Region 6. This is, yeah, for sure. Thank you. Yeah, good. I wanted to see if Lauren put up my pictures. So, okay. thank you. I always like to share my pictures when I speak because I'm here with a mission today. You know, my mission is I'm here to sell you on a miracle, right? That this is a program about miracles, that my step one understanding was that nothing but a miracle was going to relieve me of the obsession for food. And we're told that. I'm a lover of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I love all literature, but there are some things in the AA 12 and 12 that I think says it very strongly and speaks it clearly. And so step one here tells me there, like right from the bat, that I'm gonna turn to it. It says, only an act of providence can remove it from us. That we have warped ourselves, right, into such an obsession for destructive, here it says drinking, but I'll say destructive eating, that only an act of providence. And so an act of providence is a miraculous intervention, right? Of God really intervening, coming in and separating us from the food. And, you know, the other thing that this book tells me is that I can recover. And so I say it not out of arrogance. I want to be really clear that I am recovered. I am not cured. I have a daily reprieve. And I know, along with a miracle, I also know that I have an obligation to maintain this miracle. And I do, you know, and that is my responsibility, that I've been given a gift, and now it's my responsibility to treasure it and protect it. And the actual way that I treasure it and protect it is to recover out loud, that I am not quiet about this miracle. So I come from New York, from the Hudson Valley region of New York, from a Cornwall area of New York. And, you know, I know that what happened to me is a miracle. And I want to tell you enough about my experience so that you truly hear that I have a miracle, that and that perhaps you can determine whether or not you require one of those miracles too, right? So that's really what I'm supposed to do. I'm supposed to identify, you're supposed to be able to identify with me, right, with my experiences of this disease, to know whether or not you're going to have to do what I had to do, right, or what I continue to have to do. And, you know, I could just share my photos. That's one way to say, yep, oh, looks like she had this problem. Because I've had a huge physical transformation, and I'd say what I have is a visible demonstration of what it means to have an experience with the miraculous. And that's why I show it. But, you know, and I can also talk about the painful humiliation of living in morbid obesity. I could write a book about the pain of what it was like to walk through life with a body that told the world a message about me that I could do nothing to fight against. It didn't matter what my degrees were. It didn't matter how smart I was. It didn't matter what if I was trying to be a good person. What my body said to the world was a specific message, and there was nothing I could do about that. In fact, what I would do about that is eat, right? Nothing so much as soothe temporarily the pain of living in morbid obesity as Ben and Jerry's. Nothing, right? So I could talk about that, and I could focus on all the physical consequences of being a compulsive eater, huge weight gains and losses, dangerously high blood pressure, because that's where this disease had me, constant diets, and all the lengths I went through to try to rid my body of the extra weight just so I could pass as normal. I did all kinds of crazy things. In the throes of my disease, I broke my leg running on a treadmill, trying to run off a binge. After I had been given directions from the doctor that was treating me for my hurt foot to not get on a treadmill. And I got on the treadmill because I ate something, and that seemed a reasonable solution. So I could talk to you about that, right? But here's the problem with me selling the necessity for a miracle if I focus only on my personal consequences. Because what if you never reached 300 pounds? What if you're sitting here and you don't weigh 300 pounds? Or what if you're sitting here and you wish you only weighed 300 pounds? What if that, what if you've long passed that number? Or, what if you never took Fen-Phen? Right? And I'm going to talk to you about all my Fen-Phen crazy stories about taking medication that I didn't know what it was. Because what happens is if I only speak about those experiences, you might think you don't have this problem, or you have it so bad that this won't work for you. Or maybe you don't have it bad enough that you'll have to do what I had to do or what I continue to have to do. And so then how do I get, right? If I'm given the mission, I'm supposed to get people to buy this idea that they need a miracle too. How am I going to do that? Well, the big book tells me that I should talk about the mental states that precedes the first bite, or the mental states that occur once I've taken that bite, or the mental states that occur when I'm trying not to take that bite. And so I have a particular story that most people, when I tell, can relate to. And my story is about being a little girl on Friday nights. In my family, we would have a lovely Friday night Shabbat dinner. My parents, were traditional. And my mother would wait online Friday. We lived near a pretty well-known bakery. My mother would wait online Fridays to get this particular cake. And my mother would take the cake. I'm one of five children. We really wanted for very little. My mother would take the cake out, and before my slice was cut, I knew it wasn't going to be big enough for me. I hadn't even taken a bite yet, and I was already thinking, I hope there's some left. And I was already like planning, and I was little. I was already planning getting to the kitchen alone with the cake. And I spent many nights creeping down the hallway. I knew which floorboards creaked. I knew how to get my hand in the refrigerator without the light coming on, right? That experience is what food was for me. And I often, I would talk to my husband, who does not have this problem, and I would say, I know that I'm a compulsive overeater, because all my early memories are food-related. And my husband, who grew up in a traditional Italian home with a lot of food, he said, Mel, I don't think that's it. He said, because I too have a lot of incredible food memories. And then he proceeds to tell me all the happy food memories he has. And his are not of longing. His are of contentment. I don't have food memories of contentment. Because I didn't know this, but I've got this problem. I have a spot that can't be hit by food. So any time that I have ever eaten compulsively, I have never said, ah, oh, that was good. That did it. And yet every time I began to eat, I was hoping that I was gonna get that. You know, very often I would be planning the diet I was gonna start. And I would say, okay, I'm just gonna eat whatever I want this weekend. And I'll get it out of my system. It can never get out of my system. I can never eat enough to say, okay, that's it. And that's step one for me. Because that is something I am powerless over. There is nothing I can do about it. You know, and I always wanted to know why. Why do I have this problem? Why? And the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous says this. It's in the chapter, There's a Solution. It says, opinions vary considerably as to why the alcoholic reacts differently than normal people. Why do compulsive eaters react normally, you know, than normal people? We are not sure why, once a certain point is reached, little can be done for him. We cannot answer the riddle. So if you're here this weekend, like news alert, if you were here this weekend hoping you're gonna answer that riddle, you're gonna go to the right workshop, you're gonna hear the right horror story about your parents. It's usually for me, God help me, it was always my parents, right? That you're gonna figure out why you are this way. That's not this program. And that's not a miraculous intervention. What I found out was I wasted a lot of time trying to answer that riddle. And why I have this problem, it's an unanswerable question, and it's also irrelevant. Because even if I could answer the question, even if I could figure it out, unless this solution is to get in a time machine and go back 55 plus years, I'm gonna have to do something about it. So the better question is, what am I gonna do about it? If I am a person who's gonna require a miraculous intervention, how am I gonna get that? And what do I have to do to get one, right? Well, before I can do something about a problem, first I've got to admit that I have the problem. I've got to admit it. And in my case, before I could admit it, I actually needed to know what it was. Like, what was this problem? And here's my problem. It says it in the doctor's opinion on page XXX. I cannot start drinking. I cannot start eating without developing the phenomenon of craving. This phenomenon, as we have suggested, may be the manifestation of an allergy which differentiates these people and sets them apart as a distinct entity. It has never been by any treatment with which we are familiar permanently eradicated. The only relief we have to suggest is entire abstinence. That means I'm abstinent on Friday and Saturday too. I just want to make that clear. I did not think that that's what it meant early on, you know. So I've got an allergy, and my allergy presents itself not in a rash and not in breathing problems, but it is just as deadly. And the way that my allergy presents itself is I get an insatiable desire for more. Very different from other people who crave something and they take a bite and the craving diminishes. But I take a bite and the craving for me grows. And there's nothing I can do about that. It doesn't matter. It says here, the only relief is, you know, entire abstinence. And I think it's also important to note that it says that I'm distinct. I am different. It differentiates me from other people. So spending my whole life trying to moderate and control food, because that's what normal people can do. Well, I'm not normal. It says it really clear. I'm not like other people. I am different. And it can't be eradicated, can't be changed, not by weight loss. So every time I lost weight, I thought, I don't have this problem anymore. But I think about it like this. I often tell people, you know, in step one, if you fold a piece of paper in half and you make that line nice and crisp, right? I live on one side of the page. I'm a distinct entity. For me, that means I weigh and measure my food. That's one of the things that it's required for me to have entire abstinence. I am clear about what I can and cannot eat. I can't eat certain things. For me, that's entire abstinence. But I'm a distinct entity. This book also tells me I can't walk around pissed off. I can't walk around full of self-righteous indignation. I can't fight. I can't play God and be the director. I must grow spiritually. I'm someone who must pray and meditate, not just because I sort of feel it and it's like aligned with my hippie crunchy kind of thing, but it's required for me. I'm a distinct entity. I live on that side of the page. And the rest of the world can do what they want. They live on this side of the page. But that line, no matter what happens, it's still there. Even if I try to flatten it out, I can still see it's there. And my biggest problem is when I think I can live on the page, on the side of the page that I have no business living on. And I'm grateful to be here with people who I think are living on the same side of the page with me. So I'm not alone. I never have to worry, poor me, I don't get to eat this. I got much better. I got 300 plus people that can live on the same side of the page as me. You know, just knowing I've got this allergy, just knowing that, that's a problem. But worse than that is that I've got a mind that tells me, yeah, you don't have this problem. Or it's not that bad. Or you can control this problem. Because I've got this mind that wants to get me to eat again. That's what it does. And in More About Alcoholism on page 30, it says this: our drinking careers have been characterized by countless vain attempts to prove we could drink like other people. The idea that somehow, someday, he will control and enjoy his drinking is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. So for me, I came to Overeaters Anonymous, and give you a little bit of my history. I came here in my early 20s, and I had a goal. I was going to lose weight. I had been struggling up and down the scale my entire life, and I had reached a point where I was miserable enough. I was 280 pounds. I graduated from college. and I didn't have the job that I knew I was intelligent enough to have. Because my body gave a message that I didn't want my body to be giving. So, and my friends were all getting married. And I had no guy in sight. So I was like, I gotta lose weight. I will lose weight. I will get a good job. I will meet a man and I will get married. That was my goal. And I came to Overeaters Anonymous. That was my goal. And I got a very good food plan, an excellent food plan. And I took that food plan and I practiced it because food plan was my religion. And abstinence was the God I worshiped. That was it. I learned nothing. I'm sure that they spoke about God. I am sure they spoke about spiritual stuff. But they also handed me a sheet with food and told me what to eat, and that's all that I focused on. And it worked, actually, while it worked, because it was a diet with excellent support. It was an excellent diet with excellent support. And I was young and I was properly motivated. And I lost the weight and I left. Because I really wasn't interested in, I didn't want to be a compulsive overeater. I wanted to be normal. I wanted to be a normal person with a husband and a job and children and all the normal things. I didn't know I was distinct. I just thought I was fat. So I got thin and I met my husband thin and we went on our honeymoon and here's what happened. There's a story in More About Alcoholism on page 32. It says, like the man of 30, he stayed dry for 25 years. For me, it was about five, which is pretty incredible, right? I fell victim, which practically every alcoholic has, that his long period of sobriety and self-discipline had qualified him to drink like other men. And like him, I gathered all my forces and attempt to stop altogether and found I could not. And then there was Fred. There's another story. There's a story of Fred. And everything for Fred was going great. This is on page 41. Physically, I felt fine. No pressing problems or worries. It was the end of a perfect day, not a cloud on the horizon. So here's me, I'm on my honeymoon. I'm thin, I'm normal. Let's say I was normal. And I'm in a bathing suit. I'm in the pool and there's a swim up bar. And I'm like, I look around and all the other young married couples are drinking these gorgeous tropical drinks. It's like a party in a glass. And I thought, I could do that. Of course I could do it. I'm on my honeymoon. And by the way, I can't drink. I'm not an alcoholic, but I drink alcohol. I get drunk immediately. And I eat. One, two, three, immediate. I never, ever have a drink and I don't get drunk. But what I say is I'm not an alcoholic, probably yet, right? I'm not an alcoholic because I didn't really need a spiritual awakening to stop. I stopped drinking alcohol only because I could not be abstinent and drink alcohol. That was really it. But on my honeymoon, I took that drink. And that was, I think it was probably within the year, I was 100 pounds heavier, like that. The rest of my honeymoon, we spent at the swim up bar. And I didn't know I was powerless on that honeymoon because I didn't want to stop. I was having a good time. You can have a honeymoon and drink all honeymoon. That's one way to honeymoon, right? You could do that and eat and drink and eat and drink. On the way home, none of my clothes fit me. I must have gained about 20 pounds in a week because that's the way that I gain weight. That's the way I eat. Here I was married, had a husband I loved, a job I loved, I had everything I loved. And I ate and ate and ate and ate. And it wasn't because I didn't have a happy marriage. I'm still married to him. We've been married 27 years. I have a wonderful husband and we've got a great life together. I went up and down and up and down attempting to get back to Overeaters Anonymous, attempting to lose that weight. But I wanted to do it my way. This program does not work if you want to do it your way. And it wasn't until my last time I had come into Overeaters Anonymous again. I had had some abstinence again. And we went on another vacation again. This time I've got kids. I had been abstinent. But I did not have a relationship with God. That, by the way, I hold up this book. This book has a mission. It's to enable you, to help you find a relationship with the power that can perform the miraculous intervention. In order to get a miraculous intervention, you need to have a relationship with God. That's what it says here. Enable you to have a relationship with a power that will enable you, right? So I didn't have that as my goal, and I wasn't interested in that. And on that vacation, I drank and ate again. And it took me a bit to come back to Overeaters Anonymous. And then what happened was the food stopped working. It was a wonderful blessing when the food stops working. My last binge, I ate till my mouth bled. That's the truth. I ate shredded wheat cereal. It didn't taste good. It was disgusting. It didn't feel good. It hurt my mouth. And I could taste blood in my mouth as I was chewing it. And I said, I am screwed. I remembered saying, I didn't even believe in God at that time, but I said, God, help me. And it wasn't long after that I was helped. I believe God heard my cry for help that day. I really did. I said what happened for me was I walked into Lowe's home store for my husband was going to do some remodeling in the bathroom. And I had been in OA. There were people in OA that I stayed the hell the far away from because they were too serious about this thing. And I wanted OA light. And yeah, I wanted OA light. There is no OA light. It doesn't work. I wanted the once a week program where I could come in and tell you how rotten my parents are, how much my husband is annoying me, and then I could leave and eat. That's what I wanted. You know, and so there was a particular woman in that meeting who I asked her one time to help me, but I didn't want her help. And when she gave me the truth, I actually hung up on her. I was like, oh yeah, click. Well, that day when I walked into Lowe's, that's who was in that store. And she was down the aisle and I had gained a lot of weight. And normally, I hide when I gain, especially, by the way, from people in OA, right? If ever you don't want to, you know, and that is crazy. That is crazy because I always wanted to come back victorious, right? I never wanted to come back on my knees. I can tell you, you know what happened that day? My feet walked my body over and my mouth opened and I said, help me. And I meant it. And she was there, thank God. Thank God for the people who never judged me, who just kept putting out their hand. They weren't like, oh, there she is again, the girl that doesn't listen. Every time it was like a fresh start. It was like a brand new start. And what I did was I followed the steps. I followed these steps. We've got a set of directions. We're so lucky because I need a miracle of healing and there are 12 steps. It's a recipe. You can cook a miracle, right? You can actually make a miracle in 12 easy steps. You know, step two, I talked about my step one experience. And step two is form your own conception. You don't like the God that you've been given? No worries. No worries. You know, for me, I wasn't interested in God. I thought I was way too smart for God. And I also thought, you know, when they said form your own conception, I'm a bit of a smart ass. That's me. And I thought, you just convinced me that my mind is broken in this book. You told me my mind is broken, and now you want me to use my broken mind to make up God? Right? It didn't make sense. And I heard this other message very loud, because my higher power knows how to communicate to me. And my higher power communicated to me in the voice of my father, who was deceased at the time, and I adored my father. My father was an incredible man. But my father would tell me the truth. He would tell me, you're a smart ass. You think you know everything. You don't know everything. You're a bit of a know-it-all. I am a know-it-all. That is the truth. I suffer from perpetual know-it-all syndrome. And I heard my father's voice say, you don't know everything. You want to get better or not. And that's the truth. I wanted to get better. I wanted to get better. And that's always the question. You know, when people say, I don't know if I'm willing. I don't know if you're willing either. Do you want to get better? Do you want to get better? Right? And so a conception is a general notion. It's a rough idea. I did not have to make up God. I could start where I was. I could take some of the spiritual terms that the book says, and I could start asking myself honestly, what do they mean to me? That's the direction in We Agnostics. And so I think a great thing to do is to go through the book and find some spiritual terms and ask yourself, what does that mean to me? What does that mean to me? And so, you know, I could start there. I could make a decision that God is either going to be everything or he's nothing. What's my choice to be? Well, my mouth was bleeding. The choice was pretty clear. I was going to trust God. And step three is, yeah, I suffer from know-it-all syndrome. I don't need to be in charge anymore. I am not very good at being in charge. Me in charge, I eat till my mouth bleeds. Me in charge is not very good. The bedevilments are what it looks like when I'm in charge. I don't want to be in charge anymore. I basically say in step three, I turned everything over to God. I have decided that I am going to be his agent, meaning I work for him. He does not work for me. I work for him. And so I just ask for the strength to do what I think my God would have me do, and then I do it to the best of my ability. You know, I in steps four and five, I did a rigorous inventory and I put it all down. And there were things that I felt entitled to be mad about. And I'm entitled to be afraid. I'm entitled to be mad about. I've had a lot of pain and loss. It's the truth. But I heard another voice that said, you're entitled to more than that. You're entitled to better than that. And I gave my inventory over to a sponsor who received it with nothing but love. No judgment. Even though the things I felt I did were horrible, there was zero judgment. Step six and seven is the work of my lifetime. I cooperate with the removal of my defects. I am not in charge of removing them, but I am in charge with cooperating with their removal. So long as I practice my defects, they don't get removed. So long as I practice abstinence, the desire for eating can get removed. So long as I practice abstinent behavior, the desire for living in my defects gets removed as well. And that's something I practice day in and day out. Steps eight and nine, I make the amends. I made the amends that frightened me. Some were very scary. There were people I had to tell things that I did that I did not want them to know. But this program, you know, this is a program we say where we really, we become authentically ourselves. So I stopped worrying about my reputation and I started being more concerned with my integrity. Because my reputation means that I am worshiping what you think of me. And not only am I worshiping what you think of me, I'm worshiping the lie that I want you to think of me. And I actually get no peace from that. So what matters more to me is my integrity today. And I try to show up here with integrity. And when I say I live in 10, 11, and 12, you know, one of the, and I know I'm out of time, I wanna say, like, on my arm is tattooed, love and tolerance is my code. Because that is the direction that this directions really give me. I have a new code. I'm different. Part of what differentiates me and sets me apart as a distinct entity is my code is not right and wrong. It's not fair and unfair. It's not just versus unjust. It's love and tolerance. So I have to be loving and tolerant and do God's will and leave the results in his hands. I have a serious prayer and meditation practice because if I want to have a miraculous intervention, I want to continue to have that miraculous intervention. I want to keep my channel open so that I can be useful. Before I came and spoke here tonight, my prayer was, God, help my eyes land on the person or people you want me to be speaking to and help me say your words. And step 12 is the great pleasure of my life. I have a purpose today. You know, I am a know-it-all, but I try to chase humility at the same time. This program works. This is for people who need a miracle, and my God, you can have one. With that, I'll pass.